This is take two A of the interview with Dr. Harold Lineback on the 2nd of October 2000. Follow on to what we were talking about as we changed tapes. I asked if you'd been back, and you said you went back in 1970. Have you been back since?
I have not been back to Alaska or the Geophysical Institute since that field trip.
Big changes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you coordinated any work with them while you were down here?
Yes, in an entirely different field. Let me preface that by saying that after I joined the Space Environment Laboratory in Boulder, I did many things over the year. Let's see, I was with them from summer of 1966 until I retired in 1984, so almost 20 years.
You retired when?
1994, thank you. 93? We'll get it right, Chip. That's been so long ago, I've forgotten when I retired. At any rate, yes, because I got married in 94, so I retired in 93. I worked on many projects of different natures during my career with the Department of Commerce, one of which was a very interesting project, and it bears on the aurora, as a matter of fact, artificial aurora in the laboratory. And the history, in a nutshell, goes like this. Way back in some earlier plasma physics, laboratory plasma physics studies associated with nuclear fusion work, people had made a discovery of what was called a beam plasma discharge. That if you sent a beam of very energetic electrons through a rarefied atmosphere, you would excite the or ionize some of that residual atmosphere and strike what really is best called a discharge phenomenon. And a fellow I was working with named let me come back to that. So I'm thinking of two different Bills. Mm-hmm. First name of Bill, at any rate, he started a program to do beam studies inside of big vacuum tanks. NASA had the big vacuum tanks. And Bernstein is his name, Bill Bernstein, who's unfortunately not with us any longer either. And the first thing we did was to go to the NASA site at Plum Brook, Illinois, which is on the south end of the lake. Is it Illinois? Ohio. Plum Brook, Ohio. It was an old NASA facility that was set up by NASA to support the development of nuclear rockets. And so as part of the facility, they had built this gigantic, thick aluminum vacuum tank. I think the vacuum tank stood about 33 meters high from the floor to the top of the dome of the tank, and was 30 meters across. So it was a huge tank, which could be pulled down by a large number of oil diffusion vacuum pumps that were under the floor, could be pulled down to pressures which were equivalent to the atmosphere at about 60 or 80 miles high. And we set up an electron gun on the floor of this chamber and directed it along the direction of the local magnetic field up towards a target that was at the top of the tank. And we couldn't see into this tank, but we had indirect means of observing what was going on inside the tank. We couldn't see visually into the tank. Discovered the beam plasma discharge. Now, this was under totally different physical conditions than the old nuclear fusion work. Here we were working with just the strength of the Earth's magnetic field, which was low, and with electron beams of a few hundred kilo electron volts, which are about the same energy as the electrons that are emitted in your TV set and strike the TV screen and create the picture, that same energy range. Plum Brook was closed down by NASA, mothballed by NASA, after a while, so we had to search for another chamber, and we found one down at Johnson Space Center in the form of a slightly smaller chamber that had been used and was still used for testing gear that was going up into space on the... Well, this work was begun in the 70s, so pre-shuttle, but spacecraft stuff. And we continued to do our work there, but the neat thing about the Houston tank was it actually had portholes in it. So you could look in the window into the tank and see the luminosity of the electron beam, which is the direct excitation of the air by the electron beam, just like happens in an auroral display, and then all of a sudden, under the right conditions, out to a distance of a couple meters away from the electron beam, which is really quite a narrow streak of light going up through the tank, you would suddenly get a big illumination, which is the beam plasma discharge.
Now, you say you discovered the beam plasma discharge at Plum Brook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say you discovered it as a phenomena, or you discovered it for the first time in artificial situation? Both.
It was the first time the beam plasma discharge had been found to exist under these conditions, which were so vastly different than the high energy beams, high magnetic field strength, small chambers that had been used in the fusion work, where it was really first discovered. It was just that it was like so many phenomena. It actually occurs over a wide range of variation of the system parameters.
I see. But basically, you're in these low pressure tanks. You're duplicating the situation over the poles where auroras occur.
That's right. It's a good simulation.
And that was the first time that the artificial auroras were observed?
No, I don't think that's the first time that artificial auroras had been done. Certainly on the scale we did it, in the big tank, it was the first time. I think artificial auroras had been produced in laboratories. Norwegians did some work with what they called Chirellas, which were magnetized spheres which they bombarded with electrons. This was done way back, I've forgotten, 20s or 30s.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it was discovered that electron beams could come from a distant source and be focused into auroral zones. And I think that was a sort of an underlying basis for, or support for, the hypothesis that what caused the aurora were particles coming from the sun. Now that simple idea turned out, of course, on further study to be just skimming the surface. It's really more complicated than that. But certainly the fundamental driving energy for auroral displays is energy derived from the solar wind variations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this helps understand auroras then, being able to observe them when you want.
It does help. One of the later projects at the University of Minnesota people did, and others have done it also, was to carry electron guns up in, by rockets into the upper atmosphere and fire the electron guns from the rockets and see what happened. And I believe, if I remember correctly, that they had found, that they found when they had done this, that they could also strike a beam plasma discharge under appropriate conditions.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a couple of personal questions. The people that influenced you, you've certainly listed them very nicely here. Changed your life. Who was the most influential?
Who was the most influential? Gosh.
Gordon Little?
Well, certainly Gordon and George Reed, as far as my work in radio noise absorption. I mean, after all, Gordon introduced me to the whole field. If it hadn't been for Gordon, I probably would never gotten off into this field.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, he was most influential and an awfully nice guy to work for, work with. And then George Reed, who's here in Boulder, as I mentioned, was a, we became close friends from that time. In fact, he's the fellow who was instrumental in getting me to move to Boulder. He had been, already been in Boulder for a few years, having mm-hmm. left the Institute.
But he was at the Institute during IGY and was part
at
of
at the tail
that.
End, yes.
At the tail end.
End of IGY. Yeah, that's correct.
And what was his position then?
Well, he was a senior scientist. Mm-hmm. I don't know his official title. Gordon Little had become deputy director of the Geophysical Institute. I do not believe George ever had an administrative role of that nature at the Geophysical Institute. Certainly he mm-hmm. was one of the senior scientists at the Institute. So those two probably had the most direct impact on the development of my scientific career after I got it launched in mm-hmm. Alaska.
You must have had some young men or women and women working for you that you sent on their way.
Yes. Now, I did have a couple of graduate students when I was at the University of Iowa. I was brand new to teaching when I went to the University of Iowa. I went as an assistant professor. So I didn't have a big cadre of mm-hmm. graduate students. Getting back, though, backing up from that just a bit in time, much to my surprise and happiness, too, several people, both in this country and abroad, sort of picked up on my work that I had published in my thesis and took off from that point. And one of the best known in this country is Jack Gosling, who's been down at Los Alamos in the space physics work at Los Alamos for years and years. Did his thesis work under Bob Brown, who was then at the University of California in Berkeley, and used some of our results in his thesis work, some of our results on polar cap absorption in his thesis work.
Who's that, Jack Brown?
Jack Gosling was a student, and Bob Brown, who was professor of physics. Bob Brown came to the Institute back in the IGY days and also was flying balloons, not with nuclear emulsions, but with the Geiger counters, and ran into a couple of the 1959, July 1959, big solar proton events. He had balloons up and recorded the cosmic ray increase. His balloons went to about 100,000 feet too. They weren't the real giant balloons that the Minnesota people, they were intermediate size.
Where were his balloons launched?
Right up by the old magnetic observatory at the top of the hill. Above and slightly to the west of the new Institute building.
Okay.
And he also was studying solar, auroral X-ray, as he would record the ionization in his detectors by X-rays that are emitted during auroras. And Bob and I and a number of other people too collaborated over the years on several different studies connected with aurora. One of the things we found early on, for example, and I think this was a joint discovery, a lot of people were involved in this, was you've heard of sudden commencements of magnetic storms.
Yes.
When the solar plasma runs into the magnetosphere on the sunward side of the Earth, it sets up a shockwave, among other things, and perturbs the ionosphere, and you can see this in the magnetic records as what's called a sudden commencement. The magnetic field measured at ground level just suddenly shifts in all its components associated with this compression of the magnetic field by the incoming solar plasma. And we found, associated with the onset of sudden commencements, that we would see in the auroral zone a sudden increase of cosmic noise absorption. And Bob Brown found from his balloon flights that he would also see a sudden increase of X-rays at the time. So something was shaking out electrons, which precipitated into the atmosphere at just the time of sudden commencements. And that was, as far as I know, that was quite a new discovery. And as I say, it was made jointly. In fact, if you look at the early papers that were written about this, it had Bob Brown's group and our group and the Swedish group.
Mm-hmm.
A stack of authors goes on and on half the page.
Yeah. Would you do it all again?
Sure, I'd do it all again.
You liked your life.
I did. I went to Alaska totally ignorant of what I was getting into. I didn't know anything about Alaska. I really hadn't done my homework about Alaska. I just said, you know, I'm going to go and get this job. And I'll relate one little story, which can be edited out of the tape if it's not worth anything. But it was a strange experience for me. We were in the old Geophysical Institute building. You know what building that is? It's
I've been there, but it's been so long, 80s, 70s.
At any rate, it was a building that was situated on the south side of the campus, southwest side of the campus, and it essentially was on the side of the brow of a hill, and it overlooked the Tanana River Valley to the south in the Alaska Range. You can even see Mount McKinley down in the notch between the Alaska Range and the nearby hills. You could see Mount McKinley, which is, what, 250 miles away or something like that. And I arrived on the 12th of September of 1950, and I was assigned an office on the third floor. There was no problem in assigning offices because there wasn't any staff. There were more empty offices than occupied offices.
You were there on the ground floor, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, as far as the beginning of the new institute was concerned. And I remember looking out the window across the Tananaw River Valley out to the Alaska Range, thinking, now this is really a lovely sight. It's beautiful to be able to sit here and look out over this scenery. And the trees in the Tananaw River Valley were a mixture of sort of scrub pine trees, jack pines or something, and aspen trees. And the aspen trees had all turned yellow. They had dropped their leaves, but they were all yellow. I looked out over this, and every day for two or three days, as I looked out over this, I'd get a queasier and queasier feeling in my stomach. I could not figure out, what is going on here? This is beautiful. Why am I getting this queasy feeling in my stomach? Then one day I looked out and it hit me just like that. That's exactly the color of the succotash that my mother used to make. She called it succotash.
Mm-hmm.
By mixing cans of green string beans with cans of corn.
Mm-hmm.
A dish I absolutely detested because I hated stringy string beans. As soon as I realized that, I had no more trouble looking out the window.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, you were there basically at the founding of the Institute. It's certainly grown. Do you know Sidney left all his papers at the University of Alaska?
I hadn't realized
that. There are archives there, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking as we went along, we talked about archiving stuff. That's the appropriate place for your papers, probably, of that era, because you really were, you made history. You made history.
Well, it was fun. It was fun.
That's the biggest part of it. Yeah. Who wants to make history that's not fun?
Yeah. Though we thanks to the sun, we really lucked out.
Oh, yeah. Well, James Van Allen said we didn't anticipate that in 51 at that dinner at my house.
I bet he did.
He says, but I get credit for it. So, well, I think that pretty well does it, unless you can think of anything else. And of course, like I say, we can talk about it on the phone, and when you get you'll get the tape. Most people don't even listen to their own tapes, but the transcription, we're way behind. First we didn't have money, and then we decided we did have money, and that's after some more at me. And now it's getting even better, because I think I don't get paid. I just get travel. But they've asked me to organize a symposium on history of the polar regions.
And that's neat.
I'm not a professional historian, but I've gathered more of it in pieces. I haven't put anything together. Everybody says, you can write a book on this. I says, well, when I get done interviewing, and I'll be 95. So,
that's great.
So anyway, We'll get the transcription back to you here, hopefully within a couple of months, and then you and I will be on the phone a bit with them, and we'll pay for the phone calls.
Good. Can I duck out on you for a minute? I find my bladder is
something out to run away from me. The bathroom is just straight back the hall.
Okay, well, maybe I'll run down after you.